Your Honor?
Mr. Fine.
Thank you. I'm representing the appellants. They're three legal representatives of innocent civilians who were killed extrajudicially during a prolonged ethnic civil war. It's chronicled, as we note in our brief, the killing fields of Sri Lanka taken after the killing fields of Cambodia. The issue presented is whether or not Congress, in enacting the Torture Victims Protection Act in 1992, in using the word an individual in describing the universe of people who could be sued for extrajudicial killing under color of foreign law, includes a sitting head of state. I think Judge Sotomayor's opinion in the Palestinian Authority case clearly establishes the plain meaning of an individual would include a sitting head of state. And it's not denied that the overriding purposes of the TVPA, namely deterrence of international law crimes and compensation to victims, would be.
That opinion does say that Congress is understood to legislate against a background of common law adjudicatory principles.
That's correct, Your Honor. And we believe that the common law principles of international law do expose sitting heads of state, especially when their own country has ratified the international norm here, the Convention Against Torture, which Sri Lanka has done, to be sued civilly, not criminally, which could shut down the ability of a country to operate if their head of state was in prison. But a civil lawsuit is clearly permitted and authorized under international common law, which we agree, Judge Kavanaugh, is what Congress legislated against. And in the legislative history, when there are references to the kinds of defendants that might be anticipated under the act, there are references made by Senator Specter to the Iranian regime and then Colonel Muammar Gaddafi of Libya. And therefore, they had conceived or contemplated the possibility that sitting heads of state could be sued. Indeed, in the legislative history as well, in President H.W. Bush's signing statement, there's a recognition that there may be occasions in enforcing the TVPA that it could create foreign policy problems. But the Congress and President Bush stated, the importance of promoting human rights abroad is sufficiently powerful and compelling to justify that upset in the president's foreign policy. And indeed, President Bush, in his signing statement, when he makes reference to a category that would be excluded from suit, he refers to the U.S. military that would be operating under domestic, not foreign law. So these kinds of considerations about creating foreign policy vexations were contemplated and accepted as worth the price of promoting human rights abroad.
What about the part in the legislative history that says nothing overrides the doctrines of diplomatic and head of state immunity?
Your Honor, I think that the legislative history is mixed on that score. I think the Senate views head of state immunity as converging with diplomatic immunity because they're referring to heads of state visiting the United States. The House reports are more confusing, but our position would be, Your Honor, that when you have legislative history that's ambiguous, you would then defer to the plain language or what the international common law would provide. It's surely true that Congress would have authority to override international common law. It's not bound even by treaties.
Why is it international common law rather than our own common law? Well, the Supreme Court stating what our common law in Samantar in 2010, what our common law is, as affected by international common law, but nonetheless our common law at the time.
No, I agree, Your Honor. I think that international common law, and this is pointed out by Judge Kaufman and Phil Artiga, becomes part of federal common law.
Whatever it becomes by 2010, the court is saying that our courts provide head of state immunity upon a suggestion by the State Department.
I don't believe in Samantar, Your Honor, that particular issue was raised. That's addressed in a footnote. Samantar was just determining whether a government official was a foreign entity for purposes of the FSIA.
That's the holding, but the court describes, it says, under that procedure, the diplomatic representative of the sovereign could request a suggestion of immunity from the State Department. If the request was granted, the district court surrendered its jurisdiction. Although cases involving individual foreign officials as defendants were rare, the same two-step procedure was typically followed with a foreign official when a foreign official asserted immunity. Why isn't that a statement of what the common law was, at least as of the time that the court was deciding that case.
Well, Your Honor, I would read that as simply a statement of what procedures would be undertaken if there was a suggestion of immunity.
If the request were granted, the district court surrendered its jurisdiction. That may be procedural, but that's the end of the case if the court has to surrender its jurisdiction.
We believe that is not a proper reading. If that were true, it would have the executive branch, in my judgment, be usurping the adjudicatory power of the judicial branch to decide whether common law justifies this particular...
That sounds like an argument you have to make to the Supreme Court, not to us. The Supreme Court's told us what the common law on this issue was, and that's what every other court's held. No court has held that the common law is different in that respect. So I take your point, but it's a point that's sort of above our pay grade, as they say.
Your Honor, I think you, as Chief Justice Marshall warned, you need to read case law based upon the facts. And that particular observation clearly is dicta because it wasn't directly presented. And sure. I don't believe even in this case, Your Honor, the district court believed that Samantar decided the whole case. If that were true, there wouldn't have been any reason for argument whatsoever if that case is right on
point. There's still the question of whether the TVPA overrides it. But the district court did say that that was the common law rule in this case. That is what the district court said. I don't think I'm wrong about that.
All right.
Am I? You think I'm
wrong?
No,
I'll accept that distinction, Your Honor. And so the question is, did Congress intend, if that was the common law rule, to override it by creating a civil cause of action? We in our own domestic law recognize the difference between the possibility of a criminal case against the sitting head of state. Our own president could not be pursued criminally while in office, but civil suits permitted the Clinton versus Jones, U.S. v. Nixon, in recognition that civil suits, unlike criminal suits, does not cripple the ability of a government to function. And that same distinction is made reference to in the Congo versus the Belgium case as well.
So this goes to the question of whether Congress intended to overrule, to override the common law? I thought that's what we were on now.
I don't believe that the common law makes it clear that in civil cases, in my judgment, as the international common law evolves, every year it evolves, as the Phil Artiga notes, it's not
has
like
something
a
petrified evolved force. Since 2010, I guess is my question.
No, well, in 2010, there have been additional indictments against criminal indictments, yes. But not civil cases. Right. Your Honor, you're correct in the sense that the United States under the TVPA is unique in providing a civil remedy for extrajudicial killings and torture, violations of international criminal prohibitions. And so you're not expecting a whole great wealth of cases to emerge abroad.
But shouldn't we expect, at least in the statute, some clear statement or close to clear statement that Congress intended to override this longstanding common law immunity and system that the Supreme Court had described?
Well, the references, I believe, Judge Kavanaugh, to Iran and Colonel Gaddafi, at least, are allusions to the fact that this could apply to that level of a sitting head of state in a civil cause of action.
I expect something more, I would think, in the text of the statute. First of all, as you said, there's conflicts in the legislative history, mm-hmm. which point out the problems with it generally. But in the text of the statute, you would expect something more if you were going to override such a longstanding, settled rule.
But, Your Honor, I believe that it's a mistake to characterize this as longstanding. Most all the cases prior to the Phil Artiga case concern foreign sovereign immunity. There's the immunity of states, foreign states, not individual officers of states. And it really wasn't until 1980 in the Phil Artiga decision giving some life to the Alien Tort Claims Act that even the idea of suing a sitting head of state arose. And then we have the TVPA, which is 1992. So the TVPA is enacted not in the wake of hundreds of years of rulings that sitting heads of states are absolutely immune in civil cases. It's relatively recent. And insofar as, and Congress probably was a little bit confused even over the immunity issue because they're referring to the fact that a foreign state could be immune under the TVPA, and despite the fact that, of course, the TVPA doesn't apply at all to any universe other than individuals. And I agree there's ambiguity there, but I would take issue with the idea that we have this long hundred years of history of sitting heads of state being immune from civil suits for damages that don't disrupt their ability to continue to operate. It's relatively
recent. They certainly weren't sued civilly.
Excuse me?
They weren't sued civilly. There's a longstanding practice of no suits.
Well, I agree, Your Honor, but largely I believe that under the Alien Tort Claims Act, really until Judge Kaufman's decision in 1980, no one believed they had a cause of action. And then the TVPA comes in 1992. And there's this, I think, erroneous conflation in the briefs of foreign sovereign immunity being the equivalent of sitting head of state immunity. They're two distinct. And with regard to foreign sovereign immunity that has the longer tradition, Congress clearly became disappointed with the politics that was infecting the way in which the executive branch was asserting immunity and enacted the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act, which Chief Justice Berger recognized was an effort to end the political interference with these cases by the executive branch. Why, if the sitting head of state immunity is derivative of the foreign sovereign immunity, why would Congress want to have the same politics infect sitting head of state immunity that they wanted to expel sovereign immunity?
I think, Justice, the opinion in Samatar answers that. We have been given no reason to believe that Congress saw as a problem or wanted to eliminate the State Department's role in determinations regarding individual official immunity. So Congress saw a problem in the 70s, but didn't see a problem, at least as articulated by the court in Samatar, with the individual immunity.
Well, I would respectfully
suggest. And maybe if a problem develops, which is what you're saying has or will develop, has developed or will develop, then Congress can take on that issue as well. But at least according to the Supreme Court, they didn't see a problem with the State Department's role.
I would respectfully submit Judge Kavanaugh's overreading one footnote. It obviously wasn't an issue that was briefed by all of the parties. And
that part's in the text, not that it gives it.
Well, it wasn't part of the holding of the case. That wasn't specific. But I understand.
Why isn't part of the holding? That sentence that Judge Kavanaugh read, why isn't that part of the holding? It was an individual in Samatar who was at issue.
It was whether or not the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act would provide the individual immunity.
Right, and
from
before you were saying, well, why, when they passed the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act, why would they have wanted to distinguish between the two? And at least Justice Stevens
for purposes of politics infecting and in fact, right, if the TVPA, Your Honor, was interpreted like the FSI has, that is, superseding the previous efforts of the executive branch to have plenary authority to decide whether to invoke immunity or not, that is exactly what we're arguing. If the TVPA is taken in the same context, the Congress set the standard for sitting heads of state for these two narrow international crimes, torture and extrajudicial killings. Namely, if you are an individual, you're subject to suit.
But all you have is the words "an individual," right? That's really what everything relies on. You're telling us there's nothing in the legislative history that's at least ambiguous. Asking us not to rely on. So all you have is the words "an individual," right?
No, I don't. I disagree, Your Honor. You have the purposes of the statute, deterrence and compensation to victims, plus you have legislative history where there are allusions to Colonel Gaddafi and the Iranian regime. So they're obviously contemplating that, and plus you have, Your Honor,
Those allusions are not in any report. They're in floor statements?
I think Arlen Specter made the comments with regard to the kinds of people.
Well, how is this different than Section 1983? 1983 refers to every person, certainly would apply to an individual, and yet the courts have held it continues common law immunities, including absolute immunity for judges in their judicial work and qualified immunity for executive branch for some of executive branch officials and more than qualified immunity for higher level executive branch officials.
Yes, but they have qualified immunity. Our position, Your Honor, would be that international common law for civil as opposed to criminal cases does not create a sitting head of state immunity for these two narrow categories of crime.
Now we're slipping to a different argument. The first question was, what does the common law provide? The second question was, what was TVPA intended to overrule? And let's assume just for the moment, contrary to your view, but assume for the moment that the common law, that we feel we have to defer to the Supreme Court's description of the common law. Just leave it at that, just for the moment. And so assume the common law was that there was absolute head of state immunity. Then you have a statute that says any individual, and you have to ask whether that statute overrides it. In the same way, you have a statute, 1983, also for civil liability, which says any person, also intended for deterrence, also intended for compensation, and yet the court said that no, that leaves the common law in place. So why should we follow a different path here than the courts followed for 1983?
I think under the TVPA, it's not as broad-based as that footnote was referring to official immunity in Samantar. Here, we're talking about only two crimes, Your Honor, torture and extrajudicial killings, international crimes that are prohibited, as Judge Kaufman described them. They made the perpetrator enemies of mankind. It's not a broad, we're not arguing that Congress in a broad-based way wiped out and intended to wipe out all international common law immunities for suing sitting heads of state. You have this very narrow scope where the compelling need for promoting human rights abroad justified the foreign policy complications. If we ask why do we have immunities of the type, even the common law immunities, because we don't want to interfere, jeopardize the ability of these officials to discharge their duties, and ask how is that purpose served in this particular case where the mere suit doesn't disrupt the functioning of the government, the defendant doesn't even need to appear in a civil case, and yet the kinds of allegations of wrongdoing shock the conscience, to be candid, if you read what we've cited in
the defendant doesn't appear, I assume that defendant loses the case.
If it never appeared at all, we don't know whether there could be motions, Your Honor, to dismiss for lack of personal jurisdiction, the whole host of preliminary...
Well, you're not interested in a defendant you can't get money from. There must be some reason, right? So assume the next step will be, it has to be service of process, whatever. I understand that. But when you say that civil liability doesn't, in the end, interfere with the performance of the duties, in the end, civil liability has to mean liability. So... If the head of state decides not to defend in order to take care of his or her responsibilities, then they have to accept, then they're going to wind up losing whatever amount of money you're arguing for, right?
Well, some do that. Iran has accepted lots of default judgments in this very court. And in Clinton and Jones, you could have made the same kind of argument. The case ultimately settled. But I think the distinction we're trying to make, Your Honor, is that unlike in the criminal case, like in the Congo versus Belgium, where if you have somebody detained, they obviously can't even discharge their duties. In a civil case, as Clinton v. Jones shows, president can continue running the country without interruption.
But in this circumstance, and maybe in Clinton versus Jones as well, but and that's why it's been a criticized decision, but in this circumstance, the mere existence of the suit causes problems in the foreign relations, correct? At least that's what the State Department...
The State Department says, yes, Your Honor, and I believe that's exactly...
Even if there's no liability down the road, the mere fact that there's a suit pending in a U.S. court accusing a sitting head of state of something is a potential problem in foreign relations.
You're exactly right, but Congress, I believe, contemplated that and accepted that risk. If we look at a recent statute, the Magnitsky Act, which has caused Russia, because we wanted to promote human rights there. Now it says U.S. citizens can't adopt Russian children, and Putin's now stopped having arms limitation agreements, and he's kicked out USAID, and he's cut off U.S. funding of NGOs in Russia. All those came about as a result of congressional action. It created foreign policy that the president didn't want, but Congress...
Well, I don't doubt that, just to be clear, I don't doubt that Congress could do that. I'm just curious whether Congress... did do that, particularly when read against the against the background of the common law.
Yes, and my only response would be the legislative history shows Congress knew that it was inviting possible foreign complications, although it didn't specifically say sitting heads of state can be sued. It referred more generally to foreign policy complications and said, notwithstanding that risk, we believe the importance of promoting human rights abroad justifies.
You know, given what's in the report, you would think that someone would have said, somewhere in the legislative history, if your position were correct, actually we believe sitting heads of state can be sued under the TVPA. But no one ever said that.
I think you're maybe imputing too much knowledge to members of Congress in this area, because as you know, many of the statements made in the legislative history are wrong.
Interested staffers that at least would have put in the report.
I've served as a staff in... I'm not sure you're overestimating the attention they pay to these things. I don't want to be slighting here, but...
Someone cared because they put in the report that it would preserve the existing...
And others put in the report that it would preserve when the foreign head of state is on diplomatic mission as well.
But no one put in the report the opposite.
No, right, but again, I think we have language or statutory construction. You look at plain language, and unless there's some kind of ulterior motive involved, that's to be given not conclusive weight, but strong weight. Mm-hmm. And here, there's nothing that's carved out that suggests sitting head of state is immune. And think of this inconsistency that I believe Justice Sotomayor's decision and the Palestinian Authority created. An individual is used in that same reference, I think, five times in the opening paragraph of the TPA, referring to an individual as a perpetrator as well as a victim. So are you saying if an individual as a cannot be a victim if it's the sitting head of state who's tortured or killed extrajudicially? That would be totally implausible.
You could say the same thing about 1983. The question is, was there a common law which provided some kind of immunity for the head of state as compared to other individuals? Same in the United States with respect to 1983, and if so, there's the canon of construing the statutes against the background of the common law.
Yeah, we agree, Your Honor, and we think that the common law does not establish, you know, a clear statement of immunity in civil cases for these two narrow categories that have now risen to be international crimes. They weren't always in that category. I think they clearly were elevated by Judge Kaufman's opinion in Phil Artiga, but it's not an overall assault on common law immunity. This two small categories of cases where the urgency of redress and promoting human rights is at its zenith, that is where Congress said the risk of foreign policy problems is worth promoting human rights abroad. There isn't going to be any accountability for the sitting head of state in Sri Lanka, certainly not there. It's a lawless country, and he recently impeached the Chief Justice there for a ruling he didn't like. And with regard to the idea that immunity is really just temporary, this president has changed the Constitution, so he's not term limited. He probably will serve for life. So you're granting a get out of jail free card if you grant immunity. Now, Congress can do that.
Congress doesn't have to.
What?
Congress could change that. Suppose we ruled or followed the Supreme Court precedent as we read it, and so ruled, Congress could change that tomorrow.
That is correct, Your Honor, but it's equally true that if you ruled in our favor, the president can go, if he didn't like it, go to Congress and say, hey, put in the statute, the express words, a sitting head of state can't be sued. So it can work in both ways. We both agree that Congress has the definitive word.
Your point that it's going to last for life, that if that's true, that's a decision Congress and or the president would make. So.
All right. We'll give you a chance for a brief.
Thank you. Rebuttal. Thank you, Your Honor.
And we'll hear now from Mr. Berger.
Good morning, and may it please the Court. I'm Mitchell Berger, appearing for President Rajapaksa of Sri Lanka. In my remarks, I'm going to address these issues from his perspective. Of course, the Justice Department will address these issues from the perspective of the U.S. government. Many of the Court's questions really are ones best addressed to the U.S. government, but let me start with this. I've heard plaintiff's counsel's rhetorical summary of his allegations, but the fact remains that the government's suggestion of immunity makes clear that foreign heads of state, like President Rajapaksa, do not need to appear in a U.S. court and defend themselves against allegations like that, even if they reject them as false. Indeed, under international law, the United States had an obligation to protect foreign heads of state like President Rajapaksa from U.S. jurisdiction. I would cite the Court to the Congo versus Belgium case, 2002, International Court of Justice, page 3, particularly at pages 20 through 21, which I think answers a number of the questions the Court's asked. So let me quote it. What the International Court of Justice there said is, quote, in international law, it is firmly established that, as also diplomatic and consular agents, certain holders of high-ranking office in a state, such as a head of state, enjoy immunities from jurisdiction in other states, both civil and criminal. So when President Rajapaksa became aware of this lawsuit, and the district court did not sua sponte, seek the views of the United States, as, by the way, the Southern District of New York did in the parallel Devi case, President Rajapaksa really had no choice but to appear in the district court for the sole and limited purpose of asking the district court to invite the views of the United States. The United States then readily, quickly, and appropriately confirmed that President Rajapaksa, as the sitting head of state of Sri Lanka, is immune from U.S. jurisdiction. The U.S. suggestion of immunity was the basis for the district court's judgment, and on appeal, the United States has reiterated the correctness of its suggestion of immunity. In effect, The United States is the real party in interest in this appeal.
Then we should hear from the United States, because really all you're saying is that we should listen to the United States. So
I'd ask you
want to save some of the United States some of your time.
I might want to, Your Honor. If I with leave of the court, I'd like to make two
You can
points.
Use up all the time if you want. It's okay.
The only point I would make, Your Honor, is that in the Devi case against President Rajapaksa, the Second Circuit viewed these issues as so straightforward that they summarily affirmed the dismissal of the claims against President Rajapaksa on the ground that he is clearly entitled to head of state immunity and that the plaintiff lacked an arguable basis in law and fact.
The executive branch said you are not entitled to head of state immunity. Do we listen to the executive branch then?
Well, interestingly, Judge Kavanaugh, on the remand in Samantar, the Fourth
right.
Circuit concluded that on head of state issues, the views of the United States government were conclusive. So in this case, they're conclusive and they're in favor of head of state immunity.
And so the answer is they would be conclusive even if they were against head of state immunity.
Well, I don't know that this circuit's addressed that question, because indeed this circuit in Belhaus has said that the TVPA doesn't override immunity like head of state immunity. I think as
well, I'm trying to disaggregate the common law immunity from the executive branch's suggestion of immunity, and which of the two you're relying on. Sounds like you don't want to suggest or at least answer the question, which is fine.
I think Samantar has said that the court, when the government remains silent, has the ability to resolve the immunity issue on its own, but what we have here is an expression in favor of immunity. Thank you.
Please give the remaining time to the United States.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. The defendant in this civil suit is a sitting head of state. The United States made a suggestion of immunity. The district court has dismissed the case based on that. And there's really no basis for overturning that decision. It appears that at the podium, the plaintiff basically agreed that the background principles described in Samantar are applicable. And so it sounds like at this point, the only question is just whether the TVPA somehow overrides those principles. And for a variety of reasons, including those stated by Chief Judge Garland, we believe that it does not. Unless the court has any other questions, we're happy to rest.
Do you think Congress could override the executive branch's role?
That question is obviously not posed by this case. I think that because of
the words sole and exclusive are tossed around in the suggestion of immunity, and I'm before I want to go forward and enshrine that in our case law, I want to question you on that, because it does not seem to me that Congress would be disabled from overriding the executive's role here.
I think that a statute like that would certainly pose at least additional constitutional questions that aren't at issue in this case, because of the specific role that the president has in diplomacy and foreign affairs, and especially when you're talking about something like head of state immunity, the burdens that it would pose on his ability to conduct diplomacy if people in other countries who, you know, conduct diplomacy at the very highest levels were disabled in some sense. But again, that question is obviously not posed by this case, and I don't know exactly what position would be taken in the future.
So, and is it conclusive, do you think, if, I guess you do think, if the executive branch says there's no immunity, that there's a sitting head of state, hypothesized the sitting head of state, but no immunity should be recognized in the particular case?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And why do we say that when the TVPA didn't refer to the executive branch's role at all, but the TVPA just referred to the background of head of state immunity?
So just to answer the first part of your question, the conclusive aspect of the executive's determination, even if it says that there's not immunity, is, I mean, essentially black letter law. The probably clearest statement of that is the Supreme Court's holding in Hoffman, but this has come up any number of times.
It's questionable. I just want to understand the basis for that. Why in the TVPA context, so I'm in that context now, why that would be the case when Congress, at least in the legislative history, which you rely on, referred to head of state immunity, didn't refer at all to the executive branch's role.
Well, Your Honor.
In other words, what I'm hypothesizing is the executive branch saying, yes, there's a head of state, but no immunity in the particular case.
Sure. Let me give a couple of answers to that question. The first is just, as a general interpretive matter, we think that the TVPA just doesn't speak to those background immunity rules for a variety of the reasons that we give, both the analogy to Section 1983, the fact that ordinarily we would require a clear statement if it were invading some court-created doctrine, if it were invading some power possessed by the president, and the mere fact that a cause of action is created is sort of very different than the question of what immunity immunities, particularly constitutional immunities, apply. So you could obviously draw an analogy, for example, to cases about 11th Amendment immunity when we ordinarily require some kind of a clear statement. And obviously none of those arguments depend on the legislative history. So addressing the legislative history, I mean, I think the plaintiff seems to kind of go back and forth on exactly how knowledgeable the committee staffers were who wrote these committee reports. I think at times he's attributing a great deal of knowledge and at times he's not. There's obviously some lack of clarity.
Senator Spector's knowledgeable in their view, but the staffers were not.
That might be, Your Honor. I certainly don't want to put words in the plaintiff's mouth. There's obviously some lack of clarity in the committee reports. At the very least, they seem to have assumed that the FSIA would apply, which we obviously know post-Samatar is not the case. So to the extent that they make reference to heads of state, we think it's just kind of a classic example. There's a background immunity doctrine which exists. It's not really clear how well the committee staffers who wrote these reports understand that background doctrine. But one thing which has ordinarily been understood is that heads of state would be immune. And I should point out that, as far as I'm aware, the State Department has always, if asked, issued a suggestion of immunity for a sitting head of state. Mm-hmm. Now, I should just sort of add one additional caveat here, which is even were it true that somehow the committee reports had something much more specific or narrow in mind, that they weren't thinking about the domestic law doctrine of deference to the executive, and instead they were thinking of some kind of international custom with regard to immunity for heads of state, courts have still generally said, and I think this is part of the justification for the deference to the State Department, that it's the executive branch's role both to decide what that international custom is, see what's going out there in the world, see what the trends are, decide which trend they want to follow, and also to help shape that doctrine. So you could imagine there might be some hypothetical in which perhaps under customary international law, a head of state might not be immune.
Exactly. It could develop. That was my next question. It could develop in a way that there's exceptions to the immunity in international law.
And it would be
and
for.
And why would we defer, if we see that, why would we defer to the State Department on that?
Well, I think there are two responses to that. The first is that, at least with regard to the court's determination, it's just a question of domestic law. And, I mean, that goes all the way back to the Schooner Exchange case, where it says that, you know, a sovereign has to decide for itself. Now, obviously, the domestic doctrine of deference to the State Department has formed in part because the State Department then looks to customary international law and tries to shape customary international law. And perhaps if there were some circumstance where, under customary international law, a head of state wouldn't be entitled to immunity, perhaps if there were some reciprocity concern or something like that, that would be something that the State Department would take into account. But that's obviously not this case. This case is just a simple civil action against a sitting head of state. The State Department issued a suggestion of immunity, and there's really no basis for overturning that.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
I know there was no time left. We'll give you another 2 minutes, Mr. Fine. I did want to ask in the 2 minutes one question for you. So if it were a visiting head of state and the person were actually in the United States, would the TVPA cover him?
No, I think diplomatic immunity would apply, and I think Congress specifically addressed there's no dispute.
That's only in the legislative history, though.
Yes, but reading it against the background of the Vienna Convention and diplomatic understandings, I think there's clearly
absolute immunity. So then you're clear then that the words "an individual who," et cetera, doesn't apply to every individual. That is, the words of the TVPA upon which you're relying, which is the word "individual," you actually don't think applies to every individual.
It could, exactly, you're correct, Your Honor, and I believe also that if we go and think about this, so even at the high water mark of immunity for sitting heads of state, it wouldn't apply to a real estate action. That's recognized by Chief Justice Marshall and the State Department in the Tate letter. If you have a sitting head of state and he claims property in the United States and there's a matter of ejectment brought against him saying he's illegally occupying property, that sitting head of state is not immune.
That's not what I'm asking. In order to assume again that you lose the argument about what the common law said, and the remaining question is, did the TVPA override the common law, the background common law? As I understood it, you were relying on the words of the TVPA.
In part, Your Honor, correct. Now, I agree that.
But in what other part? Let's follow that for just for a moment. And the words that you were relying on were the words "an individual," and yet you agree that not every individual. Not even every individual former head, every individual head of state is covered, so that a visiting one would not be. Presumably, a diplomat, you would agree, in the United States would also not be covered by the TVPA, correct?
That is correct. Even though in the Vienna Convention, diplomatic immunity is absolute with regard to criminal prosecutions, there are exceptions for civil, but obviously not relating to...
So then we know that the TVPA's words alone are not sufficient to override common law immunity in all cases. So what do we have left other than legislative history, which, if ambiguous, is ambiguous against you in the sense of, at least in the House report, has the language that says diplomatic immunity, head of state immunity continues.
Yes, Your Honor. What we have going for us are the purposes of the act, which are unambiguous. It was to promote human rights abroad in two narrow categories of cases, crimes that Judge Kaufman characterized as made the perpetrators enemies of mankind. And we agree that's not
why
just
why couldn't
one.
We have a visiting head of state who's an enemy of mankind? Why couldn't we
because
have...
Because it has that the purpose, the positive purpose of that immunity, Your Honor, is to encourage diplomacy. It has an element of foreign policy that Congress or diplomats recognize. We want to communicate with foreign countries. There isn't a similar kind of overriding foreign policy interest in giving immunity to someone who slaughtered, committed something approaching genocide in his own country where Congress wanted to provide redress on that score. What is the interest advance that's comparable to the diplomatic interest when you give immunity for someone undertaking that venture? That's the distinction I would draw, Your Honor. Okay. The only, I just have one. It seems to me, Your Honor, that the government is taking the position that if they did not request immunity for the sitting head of state, the case could go forward, that their views are binding. If that's true, as we suggest in our brief, there must be then a cause of action created under the TVPA to go forward. That means when the government, in my judgment, intercedes and says you have to dismiss the case, there's a cause of action that they've extinguished, which creates a serious takings problem under the Dames and Moore and Regan. Because how could the TVPA action go forward if it never existed in the first instance, if the government decided not to invoke immunity? And that's a constitutional problem that you probably ought to try to avoid in interpreting the TVPA.
In the Dames and Moore, the plaintiffs had pre-existing causes of action, which were extinguished by the Iranian settlement. Here, this cause of action arises at once with whatever common law applies. It's not a cause of action which is later extinguished. If there's on the government's reading, you have this cause of action only if you don't have immunity. I don't understand how that creates a takings problem.
Because, Your Honor, the government is saying that once we filed, if you take this chronologically, we filed a complaint. They're saying until the government comes in and says no, there's a sitting head of state immunity, it's viable. Because if the government remains silent, the case goes forward.
Imagine Congress wrote into the statute, you have a cause of action unless the government files the statement. Is that a takings problem? Imagine the statute said that expressly. There's a cause of action unless the government files a Tate letter, and if they do, the cause of action is extinguished.
No, I don't believe that that would be a takings issue. Any other questions?
No, we don't.
Thank you
very much. We'll take the matter under submission.